Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 2 of the Raft Archives, a podcast extra from the Buddha and the Yogi's annual program at Menla Retreat. To learn more, visit menla.us.
Be happy to do that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mike, and welcome, everyone. I'm Bob Thurman, and Menla Mountain Retreat is a facility of the Dalai Lama's and directly of his cultural center in America, which is in New York City, Tibet House, U.S. And the purpose of Menla means in Tibetan, it means Vaishajya Guru in Sanskrit, which is this blue Buddha. This blue Buddha and this blue Buddha right there, who apparently turns blue when he wants to heal. And he becomes a Shakyamuni Buddha, who usually looks a little bit golden type of complexion. He turns blue, dark blue, when he is into his healing mode, teaching medicine. Vaishajya Guru. And so this place is supposed to be a healing place, and therefore yoga here is a blessing to the place, and the place fits perfectly with the yoga. The paintings you see around the walls and in the spa building down there are from the Tibetan set of 77 paintings that are like a guided encyclopedia of Buddhist medicine, which is very similar to Ayurvedic medicine in many respects, has some differences but very close, and because it was born in India, of course, and probably interwoven with Ayurveda in the ancient time when Buddhism was very widely prevalent in India. And this painting is the Medicine Buddha, and over there is a mandala, what they call a powder color particle initiatory mandala of the Medicine Buddha mandala. And so the thing is, when you're here, you have to feel well all the time and be happy. That's the spirit of Menla. You have to, the minute you step on this property, you have to be really happy. And or if you're miserable, you have to enjoy being miserable. And that's what I do. And we're very delighted to have Richard, Free Man, and Mary, Free Woman, here again for the Buddha and the Yogis event, and we're really, really delighted. And that's sort of beginning introduction. Maybe some other evenings I'll talk more about the place and the sort of whole concept, the mandala within which we are. Maybe when we meditate, I'll introduce that. But for now, that's it. And now, Richard, do you all have by email? Did Mike transmit to you email the Hatha Pradipika that Richard collected? Yeah. For today's thing on your iPads and your whatevers?
No.
You don't have that yet?
No.
Okay. So Mike should have transmitted that to everyone who communicated with him by email, who he has the email of. And if anybody didn't communicate with him by email, just by phone, and he doesn't have your email, then maybe we should say, did that happen in anybody's case? Everybody registered online pretty much, so we have.
Did anyone get it?
What?
Did anyone get it?
Hatha
Pradipika.
No, one has.
Well, that's okay for this first evening. That's all right.
We're not going to do it tonight anyway.
We can. Richard can do it from his iPad. Can introduce the different verses and lines.
I have the latest.
You have it.
From Michael, but it says this message has not been downloaded from the server. But that may be just because I haven't gotten on the Wi-Fi yet.
Note to Michael.
Note to Michael. Yeah.
I thought he would. Michael's been very harried with the earlier weekend, so he didn't get it off to everybody. He will tonight. And I will send some Buddhist text as well. Which, well, actually, Richard has. I crashed my computer a few months ago, and I don't have it on my computer. But he has it from last year. So tonight we'll ad lib.
Yeah.
Do you want to lead off?
Well, I was thinking that this text, Hatha Pradipika, which is commonly referred to as Hatha Yoga Pradipika. The old manuscripts don't say Hatha Yoga Pradipika, they say Hatha Pradipika. It's a beautiful text in that it ties together all these different approaches. Probably composed around 1450. And so it's relatively modern. And I love it because it takes all these different angles and blends them together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a non-sectarian. It's, you know, Hatha Yoga is basically a Shaivite. It came more out of Shaivism, but it was also all these different groups practice it. There, you know, early, you know, it's kind of the foundation of the early tantras, were people doing things related to Hatha Yoga, and so. Is beautiful because the text specifically, perhaps to a fault, is saying, well, all of these names for this state called unmani, or the no-mind mind, they're really referring to the same thing. So get over your prejudice is basically what the text is saying. And this is very much in line with the basic, I think, the view of Advaita Vedanta. And I believe also the view of Nagarjuna,
Madhyamaka.
Madhyamaka. That once you get this experience, you know, the same experience comes clothed in all kinds of different schools and techniques. And but once you get a taste for it, you get it. And so it's a famous book, and because it's accessible, and that's why I chose it.
Wonderful.
And so, and we also brought 70 little 15-page printouts of just the big, with a bunch of chants, with a few of the verses, and we can do those chants like tomorrow morning.
Okay.
In our morning sessions, and that's interesting. But the whole text, too many pages, and so you can get it, and if you want it. If you get the thing from Michael, does that have the Sanskrit?
What? It does, yes. The version that has the English has the Sanskrit in between.
Oh.
It does.
That's good.
You see, invocation, it begins with invocation to Ganesh.
Oh, that's not, yeah, with page yep. 15 is where it starts.
I know, but those are the compilation things ahead of that.
Yeah.
And
here we go.
15.
That's Yogacara Bali. First
there
eight.
We go.
There we go. See, no Sanskrit.
Oh, no Sanskrit there. Oh, too bad. Yeah. Oh, that's okay. He will send you the Sanskrit too.
Yeah, if you want to. We can send everyone the Sanskrit.
Sure.
And that way.
Salutations to Adinata Shiva, who expounded the knowledge of Hatha Yoga, which, like a staircase, leads the aspirant to the high pinnacle of Raja Yoga. Oh, very good. Go ahead. Yeah, it actually really fits well with the five stages one.
Yeah,
actually, which I said I did, say, which you have on your machine. Do you want to go right into it, Richard, or do you want to?
Sure, I got to reboot my iPad.
Oh no!
Yeah.
A reboot.
Reboot. It's coming.
What happened?
I accidentally turned it off.
Adinata. Adinata is so interesting because it's the same. Adinata would mean Vajradhara for the Buddhists. It would mean Vajradhara. Adinata means the primal protector. Although, you know, I don't translate Nata as protector.
How do you translate?
Savior.
Oh.
And my colleagues freak.
Yeah, it sounds very
Is that just Jesus?
Yeah.
It's only Jesus.
Well, that's the only, yeah.
But because Nata, you know, in all these traditions, they have these fierce deities who are the servants of the high supreme deities. who are, you know, fierce and they protect you from things, you know. But the nata, the idea of nata, is someone who protects your soul from the samsara, you know. So it truly is a savior, an intercessor, you know. Although in the Indian tradition, usually, except in extreme bhakti cases, they don't say that they can, that savior can do the whole thing for you. You know what I mean? You have to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, India usually makes you do something. The Indian tradition. No, they do. They don't say you can bomb Iraq and then pray to Jesus and you'll be fine. They don't say that usually, the Indians. Usually. Maybe a few fanatic groups.
That's true. Yeah, it's only the extreme devotion. And this is Hatha Yoga. The Hatha Paridipika is from the Nath school, which was very dominant in Rajasthan, and what's the place south of Rajasthan? You
know, Maharashtra.
Maharashtra, Rajasthan, Udaipur, uh-huh. The Nath Munis. This is and so at one point, this was a group of yogis who their monasteries became very powerful. The king was a member,
uh-huh.
and so they had tremendous political power
uh-huh.
at a certain point.
Uh-huh.
And it was a big time. And 15th century.
Uh-huh. It's a wonderful thesis one of John's fellow students wrote. The tantric Brahmins, you know, who were maybe originally Brahmin, became more powerful, you know, socially than the regular Brahmins because they were not afraid of impurity and they could reach across caste lines, which the pure Brahmins couldn't do, you know. So yeah. They more like stayed aloof, you know. But the tantric ones, or the yogi types, were more important in that sense. I mean, he did a very interesting study of that. I was surprised. In Tibet, it's like that, right?
Yeah. Because the whole idea of the Gita, of a Brahman, is someone who sees everyone equally, you know.
Well, that would be the ideal, yes.
So, yeah. And of course, that isn't the reality. But, and a footnote to that, that many people are not aware of, that Pattabhi Joyce, who is a Smarta Brahmin, meaning uh-huh. Smarta Brahmin are those in the lineage of Gaudapada and Shankaracharya, mm-hmm. or Advaita Vedanta.
Mm-hmm.
They are also the holders of the main school of the Sri Vidya lineage.
Uh-huh.
And so Pattabhi Joyce was a, I should say, closet, from our point of view, a closet practitioner of Sri Vidya Tantra.
Why was it closet from
your He didn't tell anybody about it.
Oh.
Unless, he wouldn't tell you anything unless you twisted his arm. And because he was flexible, having done so much yoga, just twisting his arm like a normal person didn't do anything. You'd have to do like a triple twist, pin him down and trap him, and then he would tell you something.
I see.
And so, actually, he had that, you know, if you got to know him, he had that little tantric glimmer.
Uh-huh. I see.
Not afraid of impurity.
So Sri Vidya is a Vaishnavite type of tantra, you mean?
No.
Oh, no, Shiv Chaivite.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
It's Shiv, okay. Yeah.
Oh, good.
But being a smarter Brahman, so Shankaracharya, Gaudapada, they were Shaivites.
Mm-hmm.
But many of their texts they would dedicate to Vishnu.
Uh-huh.
And because the very definition of a Smarta Brahman is someone who sees Vishnu and Shiva as being the heart of each other. That they're absolutely really the same thing.
Right.
Just
course.
A slightly different evolution of a metaphor.
Yes.
And they understood that thoroughly.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a huge leap of insight in kind of the provincial, you know, sectarian nature of India, where
mm-hmm.
you go one village to another, and they hate each, you know, one monastery, you go across the alley to another, and you just hear the worst things about...
Really, you know, the old and Shaivas.
Oh, yeah, they're just so mean. They're just amazing.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
While seeing everyone equally, they...
Very important.
Yeah, so I like the idea of the tantrika Brahman,
uh-huh.
who isn't hung up on the idea of ritual purity and
mm-hmm.
division.
Yes, there was the famous Luipa, who I think is the same as Matsyendranath,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the Hindu lineage of siddhas, of tantric yogis, siddhas, who he was, he met a yogini who was who was enlightened, a female in Buddha, and they had kind of this dialogue, and he was supposed to be very advanced, and then she said, "No, you still have this kind of aversion to impurity." So she prescribed him a diet of fish guts. Matsyendra, you know, the lord of fishes. So then he sat, and this is at least in the Buddhist version of the story, I don't know if that's also an Indian story, but for 12 years he had to eat only fish guts. And then this guy overcame his feeling of impurity, and then he achieved, you know, Mahasiddha status. You know, he achieved realization of non-duality. Full realization of non-duality, because if you have duality amongst what's pure and impure, very intensely grow up with that in your culture, then you can't achieve non-duality. Realization of non-duality.
That's why for a Brahmin in India to do the Panchamakara, the five M's,
yes,
is very intense. Whereas for someone like for most of us to do it is just a normal Friday night. To steal a joke from someone. And it doesn't really have the same power. So if you've say you're a Jew and you know and you don't want to eat pork, it's definitely not kosher. And if somehow you wound up in a situation where you had to eat it, and you had to eat it slowly and mindfully, you know, it would be so intense.
Yes, that's right.
You know, but then just imagine, or somebody, if never eaten meat, and you had to, and you soon, you know, just touching it to your lips, your mind would focus, and you would have all of these physical reactions to it. It'd be fantastic. And who was it that had a thigh bone trumpet? That was that Roshi Joan? Yeah, some years ago.
She has one.
Yeah, and you probably have them in your house, like hundreds of them.
I do.
Trumpet.
You have to come to my house. You and Mary. Well, you didn't come.
We're on our way.
Yeah, you have to come there. Yeah, I have a few thigh bone trumpets.
But the first time I blew that human thigh bone trumpet, because I'd worked with cadavers, you know, in the lab, you know, that's like, you know, thrown body parts all around. But but I'd never like touched it to my lips, you know. And that was quite intense, you know, to blow that, thigh bone, you know, crossing these bounds.
It's used for the Jura ritual, you know. You know the Jura ritual. Which means the severance ritual, you could call it. And that in that ritual, you are summoning the ghouls and the demons and all the vampires from Hollywood, the werewolves and all that, whatever it is. And you summon them to a feast, which is yourself. And then you visualize that you become your skull is taken and put on a tripod, and then your body is, Dakini comes and chops your... Yes.
John's good.
John's here?
No. John is he's stuck in traffic somewhere, and he'll be here maybe 8:30 or 9.
I see. So, okay, good. You'll be here tomorrow, is the main thing.
Yeah, he'll make an appearance here, I'm sure.
Good. Yeah. So listen. If you have to compile all the emails and send them this Hatha Pradipika,
right,
and Nagarjuna's five stages, if you have it, otherwise Richard will send that to you later, because I can't find it.
We had that last year.
I can send it to you tonight.
Yes.
That'd be nice.
But if you need first to compile everybody's email,
can you send it to my Gmail address, Michael Burbank at Gmail? Great.
I think I
can. Okay.
So I'll get that at home, and then I'll log in remotely, and I'll send it.
You're going home? You have a home?
I have my wife and my mom.
Oh, you do?
My mom's in town.
Okay. I'm just kidding. Just being mean. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
That's great. We all have to pray that John gets free of traffic. So why don't you read the Sanskrit, and then I'll read your is this your translation?
No.
Oh, good. So when I complain, bothering you. I'm a translator by profession, so I can't help myself to correcting words and changing terminology. It's really terrible.
Let me pull up a version with Sanskrit.
The reason for that is that most translators in the past, really philologically skilled ones, linguistically skilled ones were academics. And they translated these things like they were museum curators looking at some odd thing that people weirdly thought or wrote in some other culture. And then there are some practitioner translators who are not skilled philologically. And they kind of do it free according to how they feel. So they're very rare that they combine strong, linguistic knowledge and dedication to the practice and a belief that what they're translating is something, some kind of higher knowledge than the knowledge in our own culture. You can't get a degree in an academic thing just translating something. You have to write something about it, something new. But in ancient time, in Tibet, for example, a translator was considered incredibly honored because by translating from Sanskrit, they were looking into a higher culture than the Tibetan culture. Therefore, they were elevating their culture. You follow me? So Americans who think we have the most smartest and the greatest and whatever, we're just totally deluded. We think translating is just looking at some lower thing. But we're wrong. Right? Especially when we look at Deva Bhasha here. Okay, I'm sorry. Little side footnote. Onward.
Okay. Let's look at the third verse.
Okay. Third?
Third one.
Okay.
Brancha Bahumata Dvante Raja Yogam Ajanatam Hatta Pradipikam Dhate Swatmarama Kripa Karaha.
That's nice. Yeah. Kripa Karaha.
Yeah, Kripa Karaha.
In the form of Kripa, compassion.
Yeah, out of compassion.
Owing to the darkness arising from the multiplicity of opinions, people are unable to know the Raja Yoga, the Royal Yoga. Compassionate Swatmarama, composes the Hatha Yoga Pradipika like a torch to dispel their darkness.
Yeah.
So can I ask you then, what is Raja Yoga?
Ask me.
If they can't know, yes.
Oh. So Raja means king or royal. Yes. It's the best yoga, and it's any yoga it's the completion of any of the different approaches to yoga, and so it's the realization of the nature of reality. It can be defined according to your metaphysics. You've got to define it. Let's see. One traditional Vedantic definition is that one realizes that Atman and Brahman are the same, absolutely indivisible. But if you were a Buddhist, you would find that a bit awkward.
No, that's cool.
Oh, okay.
That's not a problem.
Cool. Okay. And then the state is described in
the spirit. We define maybe the Atman and the Brahman a tiny bit differently.
Okay.
But we'll get into that, but it would be fine to use that language, actually.
Okay, yeah, I like, Atman is just in normal Sanskrit the word for oneself. And so if you're just like I'm talking about me, myself, anything I'm referring to is me. And of course, then in Advaita Vedanta, what you're discovering is you, all of the things that are not you initially.
You think you are all the things you are.
Yeah, like I'm not my fingernail, I'm not my body, I'm not my mind, I'm not any of the content of the mind, I'm not the subtle intelligence, I'm not the winds, I'm not the pranas, and all of the, well, who are you? Okay, well, keep looking. And
you are God?
Yeah, and what is that? It's not anything you think, it's not anything. And so Atman is the actual indefinable nature of, even if you said anything, then you have to keep looking. Well, what is its actual? Atman is the actual, it's the actuality, the reality.
Right.
And what we discover is that Atman is empty empty of self.
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing, no matter how deeply you look, there's no ego, there's no self or anything separate there. But Atman turns out to be everything,
mm-hmm.
but not even everything. It's you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so when we say Atman, and everyone is doing yoga, I wanted to find my Atman, and it still has a local quality, you know, realize yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then the word Brahman, which is a separate evolution in Indian philosophy, it's a Vedic term,
mm-hmm.
tends to mean that which expands, which its nature is like this holographic mm-hmm. endless expansion,
mm-hmm.
This interpenetration where you, it's this like this gigantic net.
Mm-hmm.
Every point of the net is the center of the net. But it's mm-hmm. lacking in a sense of local quality, local, you know, just an ordinary word you say Brahman, people think of this great ocean of light or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't think of specific things, you know, like
mm-hmm.
cheese and wine or whatever goes on locally in the Catskills. Okay. Whereas you say Atman, you know, you're thinking of like a little bit of more like, even though you're not these things, you're still thinking of, well, you know, personality, fear of death, oh, I can't overcame death. And so there's still this kind of subtle dualism philosophically between Atman
mm-hmm.
and Brahman.
Mm-hmm.
And so to realize that there's absolutely no difference at all is to understand. And this is something you realize rather than understanding intellectually.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And can I redo that from the Buddhist
sure.
side to get rid of the notion that there is this opposition, in the sense that the Buddhist side starts with anatman, the non-self, or no self, or selflessness, we call it. And that's sort of where Richard just, as he rightly said, the Paramatman, the Supreme Self, is the realization of your freedom from all of the things you thought we think we are ourselves, body, mind, speech, possessions, whatever, all of that. So there's this na-iti process where no, neti-neti they call it, right? Where you're not this, you're not that, you're not the other, and then it turns out you are the ultimate, which is everything. So the Buddhists start right away with the anatman, and they say that what you are is lacking a self, meaning that all your relative selves are not absolute. So they're not really you. They're relatively you, but we wrongly tend to think that our relative identity is our real identity. As my old guru used to say, my Mongolian guru used to say, people are not wrong to think they're real. The problem is they think they're really real. In other words, we exaggerate, subconsciously, people think they're sort of absolute. That's why I like the irreducible me, do you know what I mean? And they have a self-identity that's irreducibly themselves. So the Vedanta way goes where you reject all the minor attributes, the relative attributes of self as being the real self. And when you come to the real self, you call that the Supreme Self, which actually has none of your individual characteristics, and therefore you say that Supreme Self is Brahma. The Buddhist way is you realize your selflessness, meaning that all of those sense of self is not you. And then emptiness, they call Brahma as an emptiness. The equivalent of Brahma is emptiness, which just means that it's empty of any personal fixed thing that you could relate to. So in a way, that's why it's shared, like everyone is Brahma, you know? In Shankara's, and in fact, Shankara's form of Advaita was unpalatable to the majority of Vedantins in India. He was actually accused, very soon, in Indian terms, very soon, a mere century or two after he wrote, even though they have Shankaracharyas there, he personally was accused of being Prachanabauda, which means a closet Buddhist. And the reason he was is that if you say that Brahma is nirguna, meaning unqualified, absolute, and in that sense shared, you know, when you realize you're Brahma, you realize everybody else is Brahma too. So you're actually not that special. In a way, everybody is Brahma, you know what I mean? And everybody can realize they're Brahma, right? So that means that things like the caste system, the difference between the Brahmin, the Kshatriya, the Vaishya, and the Shudra, and the Chandala, that these are just relative human-made, man-made artifacts. There's nothing absolute about them. And actually the Chandala, the outcast, is Brahma too, is Nirguna Brahma. And when you realize that you realize you are the outcast. Do you follow me? So it's radical non-dualism. And this, they didn't like that. So they came up with what they call Vishishtadvaita, qualified non-duality. And then ultimately with a great philosopher, Indian philosopher called Madhva, in the 16th century, in the 1500s, they came up with a brilliant Indian invention called Dvaita Advaita, which means dualistic non-duality.
Yeah. And dualistic non-duality preserves the specialness,
yes,
in Madhvacharya's case, of Vishnu as the supreme god.
Right, right.
In other words,
Sarguna Brahma.
There is this level called Brahman, but that's a lower off-sloughing of the,
right,
supreme godhead, of the supreme deity.
Right.
Therefore, they maintain their specialness,
right,
their exclusivity, and their political and economic positions.
That's right.
Just like,
and they don't have to wash the laundry
machine. Do the
toilet.
Same thing. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And so that's why so that's why the Buddhas and Shankara are actually no problem, very very close. And the Buddhists and the Vishishtadvaitins or the Dvaitadvaitins, etc. And they're all the beautiful, sophisticated philosophical things. Every single one of them are the greatest philosophers that ever walked. Oh, they're incredible. Indian Sanskrit is the greatest philosophical language. And they're just amazing. But the Buddhists and the Advaita, the real heavy-duty, radical Advaita Vedantins, were always in tension with them. Because radical non-dualism erodes, you know, absolutized hierarchies. And that is why in Tantra, which I believe is the source and very closely connected to Hatha Yoga, and as we will explore here and we'll discuss and we'll get Richard's view of that. But Tantra, Tantric yogis have to do those five M's. And they have to do these things that many of them were brought up as Brahmins. And so then they have to eat meat, have to drink wine, and have to have sex. They have to, what's the other one? That's three. And madana, maitana, mamsa, and probably some mutra.
Drink wine.
Mudra. Urine and feces, I think. That's stuff like
that's
that.
Not one of the.
No, no, they're supposed to eat feces and urine.
That's a different.
No, that's it. See, I think it's in there. Impure things.
Yeah.
Well, at least the Buddhists do that. That's okay. Because one shouldn't make a distinction between gold and shit. If one is really too non-dualistic. So, but of course, it's not nourishing to eat excrement. So therefore, it's only a matter of breaking the taboo.
It's breaking the taboo. However, recently,
yes,
what they call fecal implants are being used in medicine.
That's true.
If someone has bad flora in their gut.
And that's true, they do that. Well, they also sell Vermont dirt pills.
Yeah.
But there was the Siddha, do you know the story, did I tell you the story about the Siddha in Benares that Alan Admiral told me?
No.
Well, there was a Siddha, Hindu Siddha, you know, like a not Siddha probably, in Benares. There was a famous case in the 60s when this friend of mine, a great painter, perhaps, I hope he's still alive, but I haven't heard from him in years, Alan Atwell, great, great painter. And he was there and he said there was this notorious case of this Siddha who lived in a park in Benares in one of those sort of squares where they had restaurants and things and shops, you know. But he always hung out in that sort of park in the sort of central part there. And he would poop wherever he felt like it. And the merchants were upset because it was driving away middle class, sort of, you know, cleanliness oriented customers. So they had him up in court. And he didn't want a lawyer to represent him, you know, for creating public disorder or whatever he was doing. And he just sat there quietly. And they had all these witnesses about, well, he pooped in front of my restaurant, he pooped in front of my jewel shop, and he pooped in front of my ice cream stand. And they're really freaking out. And then finally they finished their prosecution. And my judge said to him, well, Baba, do you have anything to say in your defense? And he said, bring me a plate and a knife and fork, which they did, because they respect sadhus in India. And he took that plate and knife and fork, and he pooped right there in the courtroom, on the plate. And then he calmly proceeded to eat it. And he said, there's nothing impure here. And the judge said, case closed. He was exonerated. Only in India. In the 60s. I don't think it was
in the 60s, yeah.
What?
Yeah, they've devolved since
then. I think they've devolved. But Alan Atwell used to tell that story with great relish, which I share. And he was not a Buddhist. He was a yogi.
Yeah.
Because it's beyond this kind of Buddhist, non-Buddhist. Actually, in Sanskrit, there the Bauda, Prachanda Bauda, that word Bauda, secondary derivative of the word Buddha, they didn't use that word themselves, the Buddhists. They were Adhyatmikas or Nana or Bahyapas or something like that. The insider and outsider, they called themselves.
Yeah.
They didn't, there was no word for Buddhist versus non-Buddhist or something like that. You were inside some practice or you're outside, that's all. And at the Siddha level, there's absolutely no difference. They say there's no difference between Shiva, Vishnu, and Vajradhara, which is the yogic form of Buddha.
Yeah.
It's also blue.
Interesting, blue.
The blue. Yeah. Well, the dark blue is the ultimate reality color. It's ultimate reality perfection color is a very dark blue-black.
Like a monsoon cloud.
Like a monsoon cloud. And they say it is the transmutation of the poison, the klesha, the addictive poison of hatred. So interesting. The most fierce of the poisons, hatred, is the one that, because hatred has a tends to destroy things. So it's the energy that destroys the, takes apart the facade of the samsara, of the structural world of suffering. It demolishes that world, and that's why I said that's at least that's a, it would be a Buddhist explanation of it.
Yeah. Well, Shiva has the blue throat.
Oh, he has
from drinking. Or he didn't swallow it. He didn't drink it then.
He didn't?
Well, he only took it to here and held it in the Akash.
Okay.
He didn't spit it out, he didn't swallow it, but
he's totally cool.
Yeah. But he turned blue.
Right. Well, they're absorbing the poison from that connects to the Vaisvadeva, I'm sure. Absolutely.
So an interesting
Shiva is a yogi. It actually interfered with his love life. Because Uma was not sure she really wanted to like snuggle up to some guy smeared with sedentary human bone ash with snakes in his hair and like blazing flame in his third eye. She used to have to she would play strip poker with him or dice and win every time and make him take off the snake and wash and all that. Really?
Take the ash off.
Yes, she domesticated the mad yogi. She did. There's a wonderful poem. Kalidasa wrote a marvelous poem about it. It's really beautiful. It's a good poem.
Another side note is the word Swatmarama. It's a beautiful name for the composer of the text. Because when you say Swatma, you're meaning the self of the self. Because Swa is another reflexive pronoun that means self.
Right, his own self.
So it means the self of the self.
Right.
Now the self of myself, when I talking about myself, it's one thing, but if I start talking about the self of myself,
that's right.
Then you know I'm really
talking. That's the real self of the full self, right?
And Rama, it means the pleasure. So it's the pleasure of the self is the guy's name, Swatma Rama.
Right. I think this is Arama with a long meaning addressing pleasure. Swatma.
Oh yeah, Swatma. Atma, no, it's wrong. Yeah, it could be either Arama or Rama.
So he's enjoying pleasure. Swatma.
Yeah.
In his own self, enjoying pleasure in his own self. Because, of course, the non-dual, Buddhist tantricas would say, yogis would say, that ultimate reality of Brahma, Brahmahood, or near which they would call nirvana, they could also call nirvana, being blown away, that ultimate reality is not known by ordinary dualistic conceptual cognition or understanding, what we would normally think of understanding. It is known only by bliss. The subjectivity that knows that is that expansive, you know, ecstatic bliss which blows you out, kind of, you know. So it's not a matter of you clutch onto it, you give yourself to it through bliss. Mm-hmm. So the way they express that is that bliss is what knows it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of nice. So Swatma, his own self, is bliss, actually.
His own self.
And he's enjoying the universe.
And out of his compassion, he dispels the darkness from Brancha Bahuma. So And a brancha means
erroneous.
Bad philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Or bad views.
Mm-hmm.
And there are thousands and thousands, there are just endless numbers of bad views.
Mm-hmm.
And many of us entertain many thousands of them throughout the day.
Mm-hmm.
And these are just bad philosophies,
mm-hmm.
in which you're not really seeing reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so to dispel that, so not only is it referring to between the schools,
mm-hmm.
which are always arguing with each other,
right?
You know, Iyengar yoga versus Ashtanga yoga, and it's like, give me a break, okay? And then Shia versus Sunni, you know, it's like,
right.
Same. But so not only there, but
mm-hmm.
amongst ourselves, and between our, you know, our, we make many theoretical selves throughout the day, many
mm-hmm.
different points of view,
mm-hmm.
and all of them are merely point, they're all context dependent,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
and they're all empty
mm-hmm.
of any absolute
mm-hmm.
position,
mm-hmm.
and therefore, this will cut through that,
mm-hmm.
the light of Hatha Yoga, the
mm-hmm.
Pradipa of yoga will cut right through that.
Mm-hmm. The lamp of it. Mm-hmm. Can I say something about compassionate? Since I mentioned bliss, in the sense that the non-dual realization is such that the person who realizes it achieves permanent, total bliss, right? But there's an awkward element in that bliss for the non-dualist, in the sense that they perceive their oneness with all beings complete. So therefore, while they feel blissful and they see all beings as blissful, they cannot ignore that most of the beings see themselves as not blissful, but are dissatisfied, they're suffering, they're held in darkness, and the key darkness is they think their separate self, their self that is separate from the universe, is real, is really real, and therefore they suffer. Right? Like me. I think I'm really real, I'm Bob Thurman. And I think you're all different than me, and you outnumber the hell out of me. And all other beings in the world outnumber me even more. So since and then there's the ticks. And there's the
billions
bacteria.
Of those, yeah.
What?
There are billions of ticks and
billions.
Billions to the billionth power of bacteria.
Exactly. Exactly. So I'm freaked out and I'm suffering. I'm struggling with this other, which is the world, by my delusion of being myself separate from them, and that division is absolute, and there's only battle across the line, really. Sometimes there's friendliness. Mom liked me. You know, my lover liked me. My baby liked me. But it's for a while. All that is for a while. But mostly everybody doesn't think as much of me as I think of myself. So I'm in conflict with the world in a way on a primal level. And even there are philosophies that say that's the way it is, you know, and you just have to, like, have nuclear weapons or something. But the non-dual person sees that, and yet they're frustrated by the fact that they cannot blast that suffering and that delusion out of the people and sort of bliss-bomb them. Because the energy of that bliss, if they sort of just radiated it, the person who feels separate would feel invaded by it, overwhelmed by it, and they would tighten up even more, and they would become more freaked out. And they would crucify the blissful being, or waste them and somehow do them in, if they could, and if not, they would run away from them, or whatever. So that's where the compassion comes in. The compassion, we wrongly think that being compassionate is somehow to just climb into other people's misery. But that wouldn't help them. And that's not really compassion. That's just joining their suffering. Compassion is completely feeling their suffering and not feeling it at the same time, keeping the bliss so as to see, to act and engage in just such a way as to get them to rediscover that their suffering is actually bliss. You follow me? So therefore, the compassionate svatma arama, someone who's really self-enjoying himself. To compassion, meaning he's feeling that you're not self-enjoying yourself enough, as you should, and as you could, and as you will. So he writes a book, giving you some method to do that. Do you follow?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very important to note that genuine compassion requires that your duty, if you want to be a compassionate person, you have to be happy. Because you have to know what the happiness that the other person you're compassionate about is missing. Otherwise, it's like, oh, I'm so sorry for that person, but like I suck too, so we both suck. And I'm nice, so I say something nice. But it's nothing. It's not real compassion. It's some kind of wimpy pity, which then just leads you into more self-pity. Whereas compassion is a dynamic thing based on your happiness and realizing the other person could have, but they have to learn how to do it, and you then write a book. Okay? As he did. Is that all right? I just felt, because we were talking about bliss, and people get nervous about bliss.
They do.
It's illegal.
Well, you get guilty about it.
What?
It's guilt.
Yeah. Guilty, and then, but that's because it's illegal.
It's shameful.
Yeah, except in Colorado. They're okay, yep. Colorado.
And Washington.
State. And Washington.
Yeah.
And Oakland. Oakland. Downtown Oakland. Jerry Brown's hometown. Okay. So I just wanted to say that, okay? So he composes the Hatha Yoga Pradipika like a torch to dispel it, the darkness of unrealistic worldviews. And the worst unrealistic worldview that we all have here, just to let you know where I'm coming from, and what is one takeaway that it's the specialty of the house of Metta. The idea that you will be nothing after you die, that is the disease of materialism / nihilism that probably all of you yogis are free of. But that is the worst of the false views, of the unrealistic views, the most dark of them. And even if we think we believe in reincarnation, we have to excavate in our subconscious about how we felt the last time we heard Richard Dawkins give a lecture or something, or some book, Sam Harris, you know, attacking religious people and things like that. And realize that we're brought up by science teachers to think that they have authority in saying that they know and they have discovered that the mind is an epiphenomenon of the brain, and that therefore you don't have a future life. When you just blow up your brain, you're nothing. And therefore you are essentially nothing right now. Because anybody can blow their brain right this second and they'd be nothing, according to them. But that's totally false. You're never going to be nothing, okay? You have the guarantee, that's the Menla Mountain Retreat stands behind it.
Big guarantee.
Big guarantee. None of us can ever be nothing. It's not possible. Okay, I'm sorry. Oh. Just because it mentioned the darkness of Rome.
Yeah.
Okay, now he gives a lineage. You want to do the lineage? I think we should pay homage to the lineage. But it's up to you. You're the guru on this.
Well, it starts out with Matsyendra and Goraksha. And mm-hmm. So both of these are very famous siddhas. And Goraksha has a whole lineage. And in fact, there's another book that's equivalent to this that is composed mm-hmm. by Goraksha. Goraksha mm-hmm. Samhita.
Some of these people, like Anand, Shavara, you know, these are among the 80 siddhas, are they, of the Indian sort of tantrika yogic tradition?
A few of these I've heard of, and
Shavara is an important. The Buddhists have a set of what they call 84 great adepts or mahasiddhas, great attained ones, and Matsyendra and Shavara and Nata, Nagarjuna, they call him as Nata, could be Nata. So it's something, and they don't make a difference between Buddhism and Hinduism.
Yeah.
Goraknath, I'm not sure is in the Buddhist list, but probably is, but I don't recognize it right away.
Yeah.
And I sort of hear Siddhi Buddha.
Siddhi Buddha
is
could
that Buddha
be
himself they're claiming as
well?
I hope so.
Yeah.
It's nice. He'd be happy to be claimed.
Kantadi, Karantaka, Swirananda, Siddhipada, Charapati. Siddhipada could be a Buddhist. Kanyana, Pujapada, Nityanatha, Niranjana, Kapila, Kapili, Vidunatha, Kaka Chandishwara. So many. It's just like names and names.
Are any of these female, do we know?
Choli is a female.
Choli?
That's a... Bahuniki is feminine.
Could be. There's out of the 84 in Buddhism, they have a bad record. Only four are female of the 84. but about 60% of them have gurus who were female dakinis or yoginis or something, but somehow they don't get mentioned. They didn't write a book. They just shaped, you know, they made the guy eat fish guts and so on. I mean, they shaped him up. But they don't list them in the lineage except for four, which is wrong, which is bad. Mm-hmm. It's a residue of chauvinism, I think, in the culture. Yeah. Anyway.
So we can make up for that. Good.
So... But, you want to jump to nine?
Let's see. Like a house protecting one from the heat of the sun? Or,
that's a 10.
Ityadayo. Mahasiddhi Hatha Yoga. Okay, so these Mahasiddhas, breaking the scepter of death, are roaming in the universe. So this is
what's the Sanskrit word for scepter? Is it Vajra?
They have Kaladanda.
Oh, Kaladanda.
Kaladanda means the stopping time.
Yes, yes, the staff of time.
Yeah, which is better than the scepter of death is.
Yes, scepter.
Not in here.
The club of time. Right.
Yeah.
The Yama holds that.
Yeah, and so if you have that Kaladanda, club of time, or the staff of time. Yeah. So in my mind, my image is that the staff of time stops time.
Uh-huh.
But it's also the ultimate weapon that that these lords carry the ultimate weapon, which is time,
mm-hmm.
or patience.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, Vishnu has his Sudarshan Chakra,
mm-hmm.
which he spins on his finger, and it's like a boomerang, it comes right back to the finger, but it slices.
Right. And Yama carries a club with a skull on the top.
Yeah.
Which brings death.
Yeah.
But they broke his scepter.
Yeah. And so what you do is the Sushumna, the central Sushumna mm-hmm. Nadi,
uh-huh.
is the, call it, it that breaks that. Time.
Uh-huh.
Because once prana goes into the central channel, the chitta stops constructing time and space.
Uh-huh.
In other words, which is a construction. It's merely that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that construction of time and space stops.
Mm-hmm.
And so what does death mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you have that experience, the direct experience of that through this. So, mm-hmm. And then they say they're still roaming the universe. Mm-hmm. And so here we are, you know. Probably a few of these are mentioned here in this list. And we say, whatever happened.
They're around.
Yeah, well, sure. They could be right here at the retreat, like Tintini.
It's not just Obi-Wan Kenobi who can appear in a luminous body. All these siddhas are there. Buddha is there for sure. Mm-hmm. Roaming the universe. And they're not really roaming idly, they're roaming to help beings. You know, they're traveling around.
So
but can you come back to Sushumna?
Sure.
So how does Sushumna? Oh yeah, that's the second question back in the early verse. Explains Hatha Yoga for the attainment of Raja Yoga.
Mm-hmm.
So then that requires in the second verse. So how does Hatha Yoga form a basis of Raja Yoga then?
Okay, so
he's teaching Hatha Yoga to then attain Raja Yoga.
Right. So Hatha tends to mean. In a lot of the early texts, it means force. You know, like if you don't, uh-huh. if you don't just get this by hearing, you
mm-hmm.
know, that you know the nature of reality, then we got to get some exercises for you.
mm-hmm.
And have we got exercises for you? And so, and it's been explained esoterically in this that Ha stands for the sun and Ta. Palatal ta is the moon, and so these are two complementary opposites, mm-hmm. two ends of the same stick, and that it is a practice of one in the nadi system of taking the sun channel and the moon channel and mm-hmm. Balancing them so that mm-hmm. they are simultaneously open in the same way, and then shutting them off in order to open the central channel.
So the yoga, in a way, at the deep level, the yoga of the two is opening the central channel.
It's to open the central channel through mm-hmm. a dialogue between ha and ta.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so in our stage of practice, which is raw beginning, mm-hmm. it's finding the inhale in the exhale,
because mm-hmm.
they're complementary opposites,
mm-hmm.
or finding the counteraction in the primary action, or the finding the, what they call the pratipaksha kriya.
Uh-huh.
So pratipaksha bhavanam. And so in
the antidote.
Yeah, in contemplation. Yeah, you start to look at something, you start to look at its pratipaksha, meaning its context or its other wing. Paksha
uh-huh.
is a wing.
Uh-huh.
And so when you get the opposite, both wings to work,
uh-huh.
then you get a synthesis between the two things.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment of synthesis is stuns the mind because it no longer takes either path.
Mm-hmm.
And so the mind is stunned, it doesn't go anywhere, which is nowhere, which is the central channel.
Mm-hmm.
And so physically this manifests in the body as a central channel.
Mm-hmm.
And so all over the body in Hatha Yoga, we're discovering patterns of, you know, either sensation or flow, and then systematically creating the counter action,
mm-hmm.
the other wing of it,
mm-hmm.
and then coming into a sattvic state or a contemplative state or a middle path state. And so you do that in the realm of the prana in Hatha Yoga through mudras and bandhas and pranayama, and then hopefully you can do that also philosophically,
mm-hmm.
which you start to understand conceptual systems as also empty, also as needing having context and balance.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start to have the same phenomena intellectually of the middle path.
Mm-hmm.
And in all of these, the mind hits what they call the unmani stage,
mm-hmm.
or no mind. In other words, mm-hmm. the prana stops moving, and it's just like, ah.
Bliss.
Mm-hmm. And that's the middle path is mm-hmm. bliss. And so the Raja Yoga is the ah. It's the middle path.
Mm-hmm.
That's the king, and that's what mm-hmm. we're really talking about. And whatever technique you got to use, whatever you have to balance, might be slightly unique to you,
mm-hmm.
because you have individual circumstances
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
slightly unique.
Mm-hmm.
Usually sure. we're not as unique as mm-hmm. we like to think we are. We're just slightly unique, you know.
Uh-huh. Well, significantly. But then the Hatha Yoga is unraveling the knots and the blocks of the central channel.
Yes.
And opening with which up one the then channel. Does the Raja Yoga
yeah.
when it's open.
And so once your central channel opens, and you can taste the Raja Yoga anytime. In mm. other words, the nature of the non-dualism is that any system, even in its plugged up state of all knots and just being mm-hmm. on this lower level,
mm-hmm.
it is composed 100% of Brahman,
mm-hmm.
or it is already 100% shunyata,
mm-hmm.
bliss.
Clear light of
all, just as it's in mm-hmm. its actual immediate nature.
Uh-huh.
And you can realize the Raja Yoga at any
mm-hmm.
moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we all do, we get little hits momentarily.
Mm-hmm.
And so, for example, like in this text, it's not quite as clear. It's mentioned, but you can go into your central channel. You don't have to get into the bottom like we're working on, you know, to get the kundalini to
mm-hmm.
stop plugging it up. But you can go right in the executive entrance.
uh-huh.
Right at the root of the palate, which is...
Uh-huh.
And you can do that... anytime. In fact, you don't have to do it. The idea in Raja Yoga, and this is what makes it funny, is it's slightly beyond technique.
Mm-hmm.
It's in other mm-hmm. words, it's insight into the very nature of technique
mm-hmm.
as being empty. You know, you don't even need it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a joke or something.
well.
And it's something that we get little flashes of, I think, every uh-huh. time we like really connect with other people,
sure.
other beings, or two systems meet.
In the tantric physiology yeah. and the Tibetan thing, when you yawn, actually, you
yeah,
little,
yawning.
You little get the central practice. Channel. You verge the prana toward the central channel. When you faint, when you fall asleep, You know, those things are all... the reason you energize from a yawn is that your jaw energy comes out of the central channel. Or is it a little bit open? They usually clamp it shut and then it's open a little bit, right? Now, just to have a question.
Yeah.
The ha is the sun, which is the right hand solar channel, and the ta is the moon, the left hand.
Mm.
And is the sun identified with the female and the moon identified with the male, as in Buddhist tantra?
No, it's the opposite.
It's the opposite. Ah, yeah. Ha.
Uh-huh. Which is delightful. Because it's slightly arbitrary, you know. But as long as everything, just like a big point of confusion is prana and apana.
Yes.
Because say I'm telling you to inhale, the actual air is going in your nose and then it goes down into your lungs. Okay. And then when you're exhaling, the actual air is coming out, up and out. Okay. And so a lot of people think, well, apana goes up and out. Because apana is exhaling, prana is the inhale, but they'll get it backwards. Because technically, prana goes up and expands, it flowers. And apana goes down and contracts. But they're two ends of the same stick. They're totally interdependent. So in a pranayama exercise, I'll tell people you should meditate on apana when your prana is active. When you're inhaling, the prana inside is rising and spreading. You should meditate on the deepest part. So when you inhale, feel your sitting bones go down. So you're keeping the apana when the prana is active.
I see.
And when you're exhaling, you're keeping the prana. So when you exhale, you keep your heart open and you release the palate up through the crown of the head. And that way you're keeping the full you're keeping the full crest of the inhale as you're exhaling. It's paradoxical, but it's like what you do.
How does Udana fit in that?
Udana is
the rising.
A lot of people have that question.
Oh, it's good.
And this is only my theory because I'm... when you really inhale... And these muscles at the top, and if you're sitting well, the throat muscles contract to fill the tops of the lungs. So the crest of the inhale awakens or stimulates or brings to the front the Udana Vayu, which is the crest of the inhale.
Right.
And it's said to function in the throat, governing language, but it connects the heart up through the crown. And so it creates this up through the head. Then as you exhale, you're basically, if you're keeping the Udana Vayu pattern, you're keeping the seed of the prana pattern in the heart. You're keeping the middle heart open.
Okay.
And you're keeping the head totally cool as apana works. Apana dissolves all of your experience like death.
Apana. Yeah, right.
It's dissolution.
Sure.
Everything is melting.
Is there a thing also where Udana, Samana, Vyana, and Apana, all of them come out of prana? Prana is the primary one.
Prana is the...
So it's the encapsulating one, right? The seminal one.
Yeah, and it's called prana.
Right.
And then it has five major subdivisions, one of which is called prana. And this is source
prana,
of...
Yeah, the divided prana,
major,
right.
Big confusion in that.
That's same.
But the whole
the sun
idea
and moon, it's interesting. The female, see, they put the female, the sun, because the sun is a reddish color, associated with blood or ovum, which is the female semen.
Yeah.
And then the male is white and associated with the male semen. So that's why they do the sun and moon.
I
know that that influences the Lake Manasarovar in Kailash, because they think Manasarovar is the male lake, but actually it's the female lake. The Buddhists think of it as the female lake.
Think
and the one next to it is the male lake. Because it's like the mother, it's more Shakti. I think the Shakti people in India would agree with the Buddhist way.
They might, yeah.
Because of the emphasis on the mother goddess, I don't know. Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah, that, sorry.
So the idea is to preserve what's at the center of the heart,
mm-hmm.
Ah,
mm-hmm.
which is basically the experience of the Raja Yoga mm-hmm. when exhaling.
Mm-hmm.
Which is then to experience the dissolution. And if you're very sensitive to the vayus, you're experiencing the dissolution of all sensation and everything associated with the sensation. And it's absolutely joyous. So it's like mm-hmm. all of the clothing falling off
mm-hmm.
this amrita nadi from mm-hmm. the middle of the heart
uh-huh.
up through and above the crown of the head.
Uh-huh.
All of the manifestation that was pointing to it dissolves.
So that's what you were saying about connecting in a prana with the breathing.
Yeah.
That's really, really fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the dissolution of the universe every time you exhale.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why a lot of people, they don't like to really stay with their exhale in practice. It's easy to say, but to really stay with it, there's too much sensation, and then samskara associates the sensation with emotion
mm-hmm.
and memory, and you freak out near mm-hmm. the bottom of your exhale.
Mm-hmm.
And you just tighten up and then,
mm-hmm.
and you rough it out.
We're
and
nervous.
Roughing it out isn't really hatha yoga. You know, it's bad yoga.
You know. Yeah. I see.
Okay. So it takes compassion. So. This is why that thing from the Nagarjuna's Panchakrama, the hum at the root of the palate, the bindu, is compassion.
Uh-huh.
And so from the middle of the heart, and different, particularly Shaivite yoga systems, when you're exhaling, there are all different, you can meditate on all different, do pranayama in all different
parts
of the body.
Well, whom is the exhalation actually, the usual way of doing it?
Oh, yeah. So you go from the middle of your heart up, 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 through the hum, through the droplet of compassion,
mm-hmm.
above the crown. And so that allows the dissolution of everything, but it's totally joyous. It's
sure.
It's blissful.
It's the mind of the Buddha, it's a dark blue.
Mm.
So when you do it with the inhalation, holding and exhalation, om ahum, which we did, the ah is the red in the throat, speech, and om is a white, which is inhaling and building the body of all Buddhas, speech of all Buddhas, and hum is the mind of all Buddhas, so it's compassion. It's perfect.
Yeah, it's cool.
But then the thing that's hard to imagine, but this will fit with what you're talking about, the thing that's hard to imagine is that it's not working if you're like exhaling and you're thinking sort of whom is riding the exhalation. If you're inhaling and you think that the white om is riding the inhalation. If when you're holding immovable at the heart center, hopefully, preferably, the red ah, that you're thinking ah is kind of riding that holding. Those three things are just the om ahum. They have to be somehow merged indivisibly. I can't really do that. But maybe you have a clue to that. What you're saying is in the area of a clue to that, I think. Where you really, just inhaling is om. It isn't that you're thinking extra om.
Right.
I mean, initially to start you do.
Right.
But then you have to get where it is om.
Yeah.
And your exhaling is hum, and the holding is ah.
I remember I asked Pattabhi Joyce, because we would look at some of these texts, and I'd say, can I use that mantra when I'm practicing? And he would kind of like, and he said, only do one thing at a time. I said, oh, thanks, that means I can do it. Okay, or, you know. Because the ah or the om is all of the sensations involved in the inhale, all of the, and if you do it that way, then the movement of the prana is very sama. It's very equal.
Uh-huh.
If you have any kind of dualism set up in the mind,
uh-huh.
this is actually a spatial construction.
Sure.
which the mind is very good at making, even if you make a spatially, oh, the om is here and my nadi is here, and then you get like this asymmetry, and it's like at some point the mechanism starts to get clunky and rough, and the mind has to scoot out of it.
And I think something you were saying about the apana and the prana, I have to think about. I guess you can't unify them with your conceptual mind.
No, you can't do it with a conceptual,
conceptual mind. So you can aim for it with your conceptual mind, but to do it, you have to, you're just in breath his own, that's all. Somehow.
Yeah, not different.
You have to unify that. That's non-duality of breath and mantra. Is really very, very key. Vajra japa.
But again, how are we doing?
We're okay.
Yeah, we're
okay. What time is it? But you know,
has gone on.
Yeah, we're allowed to go till 9:30, but we can stop early if you like. What if people like? People have to get up at very early hour, especially the coffee maker. So we don't want to stay past, absolutely not past 9:30. Usual schedule is where we go till 9:30. Maybe we should throw for questions, or do you want to, because we were in a reasonable place to stop and verse-wise. Where you could start, or you could do, you want to do the house protecting from the heat of the sun?
Sure.
Can I just ask a question?
Certainly.
I was holding it. I wanted just to ask you, since we don't have the copies that they were supposed to send, what translation of the Hatha Bhagavata
did, put it right on your mouth like a rock
star, would you recommend?
Oh, what I recommend?
There are a few out there, and there are different translations.
I'll tell you the one we're using here. That's Pancham Singh. That's the name of the guy who translated it. And it's a very famous translation, and it's not that wonderful. It's okay. You know, I he's a great guy. But there's actually a better one by Kaivalya Dham Institute. Mm-hmm. Which is in Pune, and
that's the one John Campbell, when he was teaching, he was recommending too.
Yeah, and they've done a lot of research, and they found a fifth chapter, and then they have other they just collect manuscripts obsessively.
Really? Is it and online? Found,
I don't know. You have to order it from them, and. And they found one, I think, with 8 chapters too. And these, a lot of these chapters, that's somebody added that as footnotes or something. But
This one is very hard to find, though. I remember because 2 years ago when he was doing the teacher training, John Campbell mentioned that version, and all of the students we had, maybe 20, we were looking for, and one person found. One copy that it was kind of, we did copy it, but it was hard to find that. So I don't know if there is any...
If there's any hope.
It should be.
Yeah, you're getting a taste for... It's only that, like, a few years ago, you try to find a text, and it was just terrible. You could find, like, an old library.
Yeah, okay. So that's normal. We go to India eventually and we find it, right?
And with difficulty, you know.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, it's all, you know, and it's only recently that all of this is just online.
Okay.
And it's a miracle.
So we're gonna wait for your.
It'll be on your it'll be on your
it's
line.
The global mind.
Yeah.
Okay. The global mind has everything.
Thank you.
It's Al Gore's new book, The Future, says we're at the moment of a critical battle between Earth, Inc. and the global mind. Yeah. And the global mind is, we have to see to it that the global mind succeeds. So we have to give to the Brahma, that's the Brahma mind.
Yeah.
And all the texts are part of the blood veins, the patterns, the holographic patterns of the global mind. It's marvelous. It's wonderful. Okay, but they don't have it online, the Kaivalya Institute.
You know, I don't
know. So we have to urge them to put it online.
I think you're
better translate the text. But it's okay. The text is good. It's more than enough. Any one verse. You know, they say if you can understand any one four-line verse, if you can realize any one four-line verse in any of these great texts, then you've really done well. Yeah. That's really better than anything. Yes?
I was just going to say, I think there's you can get a subscription to at least their periodicals, which cover, I think, 70-something years.
Oh, you can get a subscription.
Oh.
Okay. Adam.
Oh.
Okay, yeah.
The Yoga Mamamsa.
Any other question? Anybody has? Anybody's Sushumna? Want to express itself?
What is the Kavalya Dham? How do you say the second word of that? The one that put out the translation?
Kaivalya Dham.
The second word. What is it?
Oh, Dham. D-H-A-M. Dham. Abode. So it's the abode of Kaivalya, which is liberation.
Wholeness. Yeah. Completeness.
Yeah. And then are you familiar with the publisher, a publishing house, Yoga Vidya? They also have a translation. Is that one worthwhile?
Yes.
It's a brief, it's good. It's not very flourished. It's very point.
Yeah, but the Kaivalya Dham has tons of footnotes and pictures. And they really do it there. But yogavidya.com is great. The way these were studied is you just take a few of the verses and you memorize them, and you basically chant it as mantra until you start to get it, and then you go on to learn a few more. And
yeah, that's very important.
And there's some nice ones in
the Indian tradition, is to memorize what they call a root text, which can be very cryptic, and then the guru explains or the commentary explains, and so you know what it means after you've memorized it. And then that's because then when you're meditating, then that pattern, memory pattern, is right there. You don't have to like stop your meditating and look up on your iPad. Nagarjuna is like that. So sometimes they're very purposely cryptic, the verse, because they're in verse, so they're very easy to memorize. But that's a marvelous way of learning, I think, actually. It's really good. Because this thing resonates at a deeper level. You know, of course, ultimate realization is beyond words, but it's a big mistake to think, therefore, that you can throw words away ahead of time. You know? The words lead beyond themselves. The good words, the useful words, the compassionate words, the wisdom and compassion, wise and compassionate words lead beyond themselves to the transverbal realization. In fact, as far as Shankara goes, when you do realize Aham Brahma Hasmi, I am Brahma, or Tattvam Asi, thou art Brahma, is not by reasoning and it's not by direct perception. You know, pratyaksha means direct perception, and anumana means by inferential reasoning, logical reasoning. You realize it by shabda anumana, by shabda pramana, by hearing the word, by sound. You just hear, as when you're in a certain moment of your karma, a certain ripeness, and of course the Brahmins tend to interpret you're a Brahmin, But Shankara just said, when you're at a certain moment, when your guru says, Tattvam Asi, you are that, you are God, basically, you are Brahma. You hear that completely, then you realize that, right? So when Shankara deals with other philosophers and talks about the pramanas, the validating cognition, the means of knowing, he elevates shabda pramana as the most important one, the means of knowing of sound or of hearing the word. So word conveys that experience of freedom, he says. You know. I guess a little bit, like bhakti, like faith, word, you just hear it, well, it stops you, the word stops you, you are that thing, and you don't think anymore about it.
Yeah. So in this book, the final chapter, fourth chapter, is on nada, or sound.
Oh, Well, that's your Anusandhana, is it? Your Nada Anusandhana?
Yeah. And in that, there's a verse that says, well, all shabda is shakti.
Uh-huh.
So all sound that you're hearing. And so it gives you a direct experience of sound. But normally when you hear sound, immediately the mind layers it or wraps it with some kind of meaning, particularly with language too.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're hearing nada, you're hearing infinity, mm-hmm. rather than hearing meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And so this type of language
mm-hmm.
is, it's kind of self-referential. It's referring back onto itself. And at a certain point, when singing some of these hymns or something,
mm-hmm.
the mind actually stops wrapping the sound in vritti, or mm-hmm. meaning. Oh, mm-hmm. the word Vishnu means big guy, or the word, you know, you no longer go on and, well, what I'm, you hear the sound and your mind goes off the sound into what the sound is supposed to mean. And then
right.
that takes you on to another meaning, and you're just off on this chain
mm-hmm.
of thinking. And so the whole idea is that we stop that chain of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We cut the chain through this kind of self-referential poetry in which you actually start to hear sound
mm-hmm.
as an innocent would. Almost like, well, here at Menla, like last night we, you know, there weren't many people here, and the windows were open in the bedroom, and it was just bugs, crickets, and chirpy little bugs, and then the sound of the river, and it was just like,
oh. You could hear the river. It was like,
yeah, from
the rain.
Fantastic.
Oh, my God.
Ah, that was nada. But if I sat there thinking, oh, I hear the river, isn't that delightful? Mm-hmm. Then I was just wrapping it. And so the practice is just to go back and back.
That's marvelous. We had a Menla has that thing. I told you about the violinist lady we had here.
No.
A year or two ago, we had a lady who was a New York Philharmonic violinist, Korean American, tall, willowy, lovely lady, very sensitive, and a really like a virtuoso violinist, and first violin in the New York Philharmonic, and then something happened where her hearing became excruciating to her. And so she had to take leave from her job, and even every sound, and even her daughter talking in the house, and it was like, any sound became like horrible. And then she, of course, went to the industrial doctors, and eventually they sent her, they couldn't do anything, and then eventually they sent her to some place in Maryland for PTSD people who were shell-shocked. And they put her in an fMRI machine, and totally scrambled her brain where it was like agony to hear anything. She was going around with earmuffs. So she came up here to Menla. Sharon Salzberg and I were teaching. And she thought maybe she'd learn some meditating. But then, probably it was my voice, not Sharon's, but she couldn't stand listening to whatever we had to say, even staying far in the back. And so she stopped coming to the talk after one talk, or halfway through one talk. And then we were very worried, and she sort of disappeared. And then I made an appointment with her to discuss how we could somehow transmit to her what we were trying to share, and how she could maybe meditate and calm herself down. And she told us her story. And then by the time she came to that appointment, she was all happy, and she was able to talk and listen and came to the classes. And we said, well, what happened? And she said, well, she said, I had a dream that I should listen to the leaves and to the water. And because I was despairing, my voice apparently drove her to despair. Like it does my wife often. Anyway, drove myself deaf, I think. And then, so she went down to the stream here at a time in the summer when it was not now where there's a rushing water because we've had so much rain. It was very little trickly water down by where we do the sweat lodges sometimes in that part. And she a little bit listened to the leaves, the breeze in the leaves, but that was a little too harsh. So she then sort of lay down near that stream and she listened to the trickling water, she said. Mm. And listening to that trickling water for some hours, And then she was able to hear the leaves of the trees. And then by one or two afternoons like that, or a day and an after a day and a morning like that, in the afternoon, she was able to talk with us, and she felt healed by the sound of the nature of Menla. And then she went to the office. We didn't have Mike Burbank here, unfortunately. We had some bureaucratic person, and she said, "I'm going to stay here for 3 months." And he said, "Oh, we can't give you here for 3 months." And then she was all discouraged by it. But then we told her what she could, if she needed, that she had her daughter. And then she was able to hear after, you know, a week or so. Just not from us, but listening to the earth here, the nature.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
We were very touched. Made us feel more heavily responsible. Take care of Menla. And to make it available to people. And okay, then you're going to go to sleep early, because you have to get up early. And there's a wonderful Buddhist thing that you do, where you can, as you're falling asleep, you simply think about, now I'm going to sleep. And this is not dream yoga, it's sleep yoga. And you think that I'm going to withdraw, in order to sleep, I'm going to withdraw from my visual field, my tactile field, my smell field, and my taste field. I brush my teeth, and I have a soft pillow, organic cotton we have at Menla, and I'm putting my face down. And then last is hearing field. And then where my mind field is going on, which is thinking, the mental objects internally, the sixth sense. So I'm going to withdraw from active conceptual imaginational thinking. But I'm going to imagine that I let every cell in my body, everything, go into clear light through sunlight, sort of dark light. But when it goes dark, when I go unconscious, I'm not going into nothingness, because there is no such thing. I realize nothing is nothing, so I can't go there. It's not a place. So then I go into this transparent, clear light, and I entrust every cell in my body, every bacteria in my microbiome, every fiber in my neuron in my brain, I entrust it to the body of Brahma, the body of Vajradhara, the body of Buddha, the clear light of the void, so that I will wake up ready for yoga, Mysore-style yoga. I won't even need any coffee. I'll be so energized. Okay? Thank you. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you.
Thank you, Swatmarama. And Mary, always Mary. Good night.
Thanks for tuning in, and if you enjoy these podcast extras, please let us know. This is Justin Stone Diaz, and I can be reached on most social media platforms as Justin Stoned. Or please email me. My email is justin@menla.org. As always, the interstitial music for the Bob Thurman podcast is provided by our dear friend Tenzing Chogyo. And don't forget, please be sure to subscribe to the Bob Thurman Podcast on all your favorite social media platforms. Tashi Dilek.